This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This October, postseason baseball reeks of history. In Chicago tomorrow, the Cubs have a chance to win their first National League pennant since 1945, though the upstart Florida Marlins aren't out of it yet. In the American League, the Boston Red Sox not only have a chance to win, but to eliminate their hated tormentors, the New York Yankees, along the way. If this brace of perennial also-rans does make it into the World Series, a championship banner will fly at either Wrigley Field or Fenway Park amid what many expect will be a plague of locusts, or something else appropriately biblical. This hour we'll look back at historic moments in the World Series, how they shaped baseball and reflected life away from the diamond. It's now 100 years since the first was played. How does today compare with 1903? How did baseball recover from the 1919 Black Sox scandal and from the strike in 1994? Join the conversation. Which World Series do you think marked a turning point for baseball and why? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. But first, we'll catch up more where things stand in the playoffs right now. Joining us from the Bureau in New York is Alan Schwartz, a senior writer with Baseball America. And Alan, good to have you on the program again.
Well, thank you, Neil. It's good to be here.
I guess we have to go to the American League first and the remarkable occurrences of Game 3 Saturday night, which erupted into the famous bench-clearing brawl.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that some of the coverage of the event has been a little skewed. I don't see how anyone other than Don Zimmer should have been thrown out of that game. I think the umpires did a fantastic job, but people coming out and saying Pedro should have been arrested, including Mayor Bloomberg, I think are completely off base.
We might want to remind people, Pedro Martinez, the brilliant starting pitcher for the Boston Red Sox, who has something of a reputation for occasionally hurling a fastball at a player's head. Don Zimmer, the bench coach for the New York Yankees, they got into a shoving match. The 72-year-old Zimmer ran up fists up to the 31-year-old Martinez, who grabbed him by the head and threw him to the ground. But this only part of the goings-on in what turned out to be, if you looked aside from the antics, a pretty good baseball game.
Oh, it was a fantastic game, and particularly in the ninth inning. Some people recall there was an incident out in right field in the bleachers where a Red Sox employee, a member of the grounds crew, got into a tiff with a few of the Yankee relievers, and then the Yankee right fielder jumped over the fence. And it's just, you know, it's just a great manifestation of the emotions that run so high with this rivalry. Certainly no one hopes anyone gets hurt. That goes without saying. But, you know, round four begins in a few hours, and I think everyone's on the edge of his seat anticipating this.
Postponed from yesterday because of rain. Meanwhile, in the National League, the Cubs had taken a 3-1 lead over the Florida Marlins, but celebrations postponed after a brilliant pitching performance there yesterday.
Well, I think a lot of people have forgotten that the Florida Marlins have an excellent young pitching staff themselves. There has been a lot of talk about the Cubs' excellent young right-handers, Kerry Wood, who has been around for a little while, of course, burst on the scene in 1998 when he struck out 20 batters in a game, and then Mark Pryor, who arrived in the big leagues last year and this year could end up winning the Cy Young Award in his first full season. Those two guys are fantastic. They are wonderful anchors for the Cubs. But the Marlins, of course, have good young arms themselves, and the best of them, even better than the rookie sensation this year, Dontrell Willis, is Josh Beckett. Josh Beckett is the next in the long line of Texas pitching phenoms, whether it's Nolan Ryan, Roger Clemens, Kerry Wood. Now it's Josh Beckett, and the country has found that out in this postseason, not only in the first round against the Giants, but yesterday when he threw the two-hit shutout. Josh Beckett might be the best young pitcher in the postseason.
Awfully good pitching performance yesterday. Ended up being a two-hit shutout.
Mm-hmm.
That's good stuff against clearly one of the best teams in baseball, and the Cubs had been hitting the ball extremely well. And of course, Cubs fans leading this series, of course, they want to be there. But on the other hand, they can hear the footsteps of history. If they should lose Game 6, it's going to put an awful lot of pressure on their young pitching staff in Wrigley Field.
Well, it will just be an incredibly exciting game, and I think one of the things we're seeing in this postseason is the nation waking up to the other storylines that baseball can offer. It's not only about the Yankees. There are lots of other great storylines. And last year, for instance, the Angels, no one really knew outside of, you know, baseball insiders who the Angels were. There weren't a lot of exciting stories. But this year, in addition to the Yankees, so you get, you know, 60% of the country that way, you have the Red Sox, you have the Cubs, you have all the feelings associated with those clubs and the passions of each region, Boston and the Midwest, and all the fans who grew up listening to Harry Caray. There's so much more out there now to root for or against than there have been in a few years. I think that's really the main reason, of course, why the television ratings are up almost 50%.
Way up. They expected them to be up because the cities involved include some of the larger markets in the country, but that's way up.
Yeah, I think, like I said, the reason is that everyone has feelings associated with Boston and feelings associated with the Cubs and feelings associated with the Yankees. And so three of the four teams elicit some sort of passion, whether positive or negative. The Marlins, I mean, look, you have all 17 Marlins fans watching, and that's got to help.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. We're talking not only about this World Series, but of those in the past in particular, 100 years since the first one was played. Which one do you think provided a turning point and why? You can also email us, TOTN@NPR.org. And Leif joins us on the line from Laramie, Wyoming.
Oh, hello. Glad to be on the show. I believe that a turning point to the World Series really, I think, was in the 1960 World Series when the Pirates defeated the Yankees in seven games.
Bill Mazeroski's famous home run in Forbes Field.
Yeah, it was in the bottom ninth, I believe, too, in Game 7.
I believe it was.
Just the fact that it's the bottom ninth, Game 7 doesn't get any better than that. It's a kind of a lesser-known player. Maybe he was more popular in that time frame. But compared with, you know, other World Series, the World Series heroes are not necessarily well-known, famous sluggers. It could be like Jim Leyritz of the Yankees in 96.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, a relief pitcher. It doesn't have to be the ace of the staff or the biggest slugger. And that is the beauty of the World Series. Anybody can be a hero.
Well, Alan Schwartz, surely if you go back and look at that World Series, it was the most lopsided advantage for the Yankees, who somehow managed to lose. They wildly outscored the Pirates in that series, and still those guys managed to come back and win.
Well, I think something like the final scoring was Yankees 49, Pirates 22, or something like that. And yet, of course, the Yankees managed to lose four out of the seven games, and that's how it works. I think one of the things that the caller alluded to about how, you know, usually it's the lesser known guys who are the heroes, that's an indication of the way baseball usually is. If you take a look at most games of the season, it's not your Sammy Sosa's and Mark McGuire's and Juan Gonzalez's and whatnot who end up being the heroes of each game. When you have such a small sample, like you do in the postseason, of five or seven games, you're going to have one guy who's going to end up hitting 450, who, you know, you never would have thought would hit 450 during that time. But because baseball's like that, and the big sluggers, the opponent doesn't want the big slugger to hurt him, so he sort of takes his chances with the little guy, well, the little guy's going to come through. Bill Mazeroski in 1960... of course, very well known for his defense. This guy was probably the best defensive second baseman of all time.
Got into Cooperstown with his glove.
Exactly. I mean, maybe Roberto Alomar, it's hard to know. Roberto Alomar, of course, the modern player right now. But, you know, you see that in the World Series all the time. I mean, Don Larson, 4 years before Mazeroski in 1956, throws a perfect game. No one thought he would win, even. Sandy Amoros makes that fantastic catch in 1955 to help the Dodgers. Every year, a nobody makes a name for himself. And I think that's one of the beauties of baseball. You don't get that in, for instance, basketball, where it's 5-on-5 and your Jordans and Michael Jordans and Karl Malones and whatnot are always going to come to the fore because that's the way the game is designed. Baseball is designed for the little guy. And that's, I think, one of the true pleasures of watching.
Leif, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, sir.
And Alan, we're going to check back in with you a little later in the program to talk about baseball's modern history, so stand by with us there in the New York Bureau. But before we get too far ahead of ourselves, we thought we'd remind everyone where the World Series began, and that was the year 1903. The teams were the Boston Americans. 4 years away from earning the nickname Red Sox, facing at the time the Pittsburgh Pirates. Joining us now from his office in Boston is Roger Abrams, the author of the first World Series and the Baseball Fanatics of 1903. And good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
My pleasure, Neil.
Remind us a little bit, you're part of the reason you wrote this book. You teach law at Northeastern University, which is now where the Boston baseball field used to be.
Yes, about 50 feet away from my office, where I'm sitting now, was the Huntington Avenue grounds, which had been built for the new American League club that was started in 1901. And by 1903, it was time to create a World Series.
There's an astonishing picture on the cover of your book of, I guess it's game three of that World Series, where and it's before the game. It's not a celebration after. The people are crowded onto the field. There were restraining ropes in the outfield, but they've burst through and are crowded around the. What's going on there?
Well, you know that if you only have a stadium that fits 9,000 people to sit on the in the stands, or what were called the bleaching boards. Now we just call them bleachers. That you're going to have to put your excess people somewhere. And they did, way out in the outfield, because no one could possibly hit the ball that far. The problem was that at 2 o'clock, the Boston Americans came out to take infield practice. And it was a Saturday, beautiful Saturday afternoon, and the crowds just rushed the field to get close to their heroes. And indeed they did, and it took the police an hour to push them back, but only could push them back another 100 feet or so. And so the two captains came up with a ground rule that any ball hit into the crowd would be a double. And that day, the Pittsburghers hit seven of those to win the third game of the World Series.
And this World Series featured some of the great names of the era: Hannes Wagner, who was a great shortstop for the Pirates. Cy Young started and won the first game for the Bostons there. But one of the things you write about so intriguingly is the people who were at the game. And you quote from the Boston Post. The Boston Post reported that everybody seemed to be at the game. Businessmen rubbed shoulders with their clerks, and City Hall Pauls and their heelers were on an equal footing, like a Harvard-Yale football game. Almost everyone of any importance was to be seen. This was the great melting pot. This was America writ small, I guess.
And as far as I could tell, it was the only time that people from different classes and different backgrounds would come together in one place and root for one outcome all together. You would have the Boston Brahmins who came down from Beacon Hill, such as John I. Taylor, the son of the owner of the Boston Globe, who the next year would become the owner of the club because he couldn't do much else. And so he owned the Boston franchise, renamed it the Red Sox, and built Fenway Park, and then left baseball history. But he brought with him a lot of his high-class friends. They filled the sports pages with stories about the notables who were in attendance.
And if this year's Red Sox offer the karaoke rally guy, there was a song of their own, the Tess.
Well, the song was the theme song, or so it became, of the Boston Royal Rooters, a group of 150 Irishmen who would come to every game all year long wearing their Sunday best and their bowler hats. And for each of the games of the postseason, they rented a different band. And they got tired of singing the same old songs, and so they found some new music, a Broadway hit called Tessie. But then they rewrote the lyrics in order to support their great captain and manager, Jimmy Collins, a future Hall of Famer, but also to make fun of Hannes Wagner. And 25 years later, Hannes Wagner said, "You know that Tessie song? I hate that Tessie song."
And recalled by many others as the crucial moment, and of course that helped those Royal Rooters help turn the series around when it went to Pittsburgh. Thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Neil.
Roger Abrams is the author of the first World Series and the Baseball Fanatics of 1903. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's October. We're discussing how various World Series have shaped baseball lore and baseball today. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a phone call. It's 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. One of the darkest moments in baseball history was that of the 1919 World Series. the famous Black Sox scandal. And joining us now from his home in Scotia, New York, is David Pietruszka. He's the author of Rothstein, The Life, the Times, and Murder of the Criminal Genius Who Fixed the 1919 World Series. Good of you to be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And you give Arnold Rothstein, a man known as The Brain, you give him a rather greater role in the 1919 scandal than most people do.
Yeah, most people think he was. There were two ends of the scandal, two sets of gamblers who were offering money at the Black Sox. And history, or the accepted history, says Arnold Rothstein was only in on one of the fixes, as if that's an excuse.
Yeah.
But I've come to the conclusion he was in on both for a number of reasons, in that he was the only man with the money and the nerve to do it in terms of the time frames of how things were arranged, in terms of how broke Abe Attell was 5 games before the series starts, where he's pawning his wife's jewelry in Chicago, where his associates come from, and the extraordinary measures that Arnold Rothstein went to after this fix was exposed to make sure that Abe Attell wouldn't talk.
And before we get too far, people may not remember too well who Arnold Rothstein was in the litany of American gangsterdom. He's overshadowed by the likes of Al Capone and thugs like that. But this is a man who might be more memorable to listeners as Nathan Detroit.
That's right. He morphed into sort of a literary figure. He was the model for Nathan Detroit in Guys and Dolls, Damon Runyon's remarkable film and story. He was a friend of Damon Runyon. He was also not a friend of F. Scott Fitzgerald, but he met him once, and F. Scott Fitzgerald put him into The Great Gatsby as the character Meyer Wolfsheim, the man who fixed the World Series, and he was too smart old man to be caught. He was not a gangster in terms of a thug, a Lower East Side thug, or territorial fellow like the Gottis or Capone or something like that. He was more the Napoleon of crime type, the Professor Moriarty from the Sherlock Holmes stories, where he would advance the money, he would be the go-between between police and such. He would be involved in rum running and speakeasies, labor racketeering, fencing millions of dollars in stolen bonds with Nicky Arnstein, who most people can remember from Funny Girl, Funny Lady, as Fanny Bryce's ne'er-do-well husband.
And remind us, though, at the time, it was not exactly unknown to fix baseball games.
That's the sad part of the story, or the sadder part, that baseball and gambling went together for quite a long time. The national pastime was almost wrecked as far back as the 1870s, when there was a gambling scandal that wrecked the Louisville club. These things sort of continued onward. 1914, there were some rumors of a fix. 1917, Heinie Zimmerman with the Chicago Cubs was under suspicion. And in 1918, there was a plot out of St. Louis, which never quite got off the ground because there wasn't enough money to do it, to fix that World Series, the famous Cubs-Red Sox World Series, which we may be seeing round two of. But those fellows who tried to fix that 1918 World Series turned out to be some of Arnold Rothstein's accomplices in 1919.
You write that the players who were involved, the famous Black Sox, or Elliot Bazanoff's famous book, Eight Men Out, later made into a movie, yes, they did have their objections to the skinflint Charles Comiskey, who underpaid them and exploited them, but as you point out, they probably, many of them, would have stolen it anyway.
Exactly. Gandel, Risberg, and even Eddie Seacott, who comes across fairly well and sympathetically in the movie. And he was a fellow who showed genuine remorse. I mean, bad people or people who do very bad things can, in fact, turn their lives around and turn into decent human beings. But Seacott was a very greedy fellow, so you had a basis of three fellows like that, and then you had some more susceptible fellows like Felsch and Jackson. And finally, Buck Weaver, the third baseman, who really didn't do anything but had guilty knowledge. And Judge Landis felt that in a time of crisis like that, you had to set some new rules and some new standards. And Buck Weaver was the one fellow who had to go because it created a new standard for honesty in baseball, where if you knew crookedness was going on, even if you were not going to be involved in it, you had to rat on your sort of an on-the-waterfront sort of story.
Hmm.
And this is what cleans up the game of baseball, because the crooks can no longer trust the honest players to keep quiet.
And the Jackson you mentioned, of course, Shoeless Joe Jackson.
With Joe.
Say It Ain't So Joe, and, of course, later Field of Dreams.
Right. Shoeless Joe is an interesting case. He hits .375 during the series, and he hits the only home run of the World Series. So people say, how could he have done anything wrong? I mean, yes, he took the money, which would generally be somewhat suspicious. But if you look at when he went hitless, and he went hitless in one game of that eight-game series, it was in the game following when he actually got the money. We also see that when he hit, often it was in non-crucial situations, and that his home run came in, very late in the eighth game when the whole series and that game itself was out of reach. And Joe Jackson was the fellow who, his glove was known as the place where triples went to die.
I thought that was Tris Speaker's glove.
Well, maybe they both shared the same glove.
Could have been.
It was a trade. But in any case, he was a damn good fielder. And nonetheless, the Cincinnati Reds hit two triples to left field in that eight-game series, and that's damn hard to do.
Well, the entire story is told in David Pietrucha's new book, Rothstein, The Life, Times, and Murder of the Criminal Genius Who Fixed the 1919 World Series. And, David, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And let's get back now to Alan Schwartz, who is with us from our Bureau in New York, a senior writer for Baseball America. And back to your calls, 800-989-8255. And let's go right to Chris, who's with us from Stevenson, Washington.
Good morning. This is Chris out in the Columbia Gorge.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to call and said that I think that the World Series that has taught us the most was the 1955 World Series, because it did teach us that the Yankees were mortal as they finally lost to the Dodgers.
It was finally next year.
It was indeed. My father always talks about that being a big moment in his life, and the darkest moment being the shot heard around the world in 51.
I take it he was a Dodger fan.
Most certainly, and we're a family of Dodger fans, but I always root for a Cubs-Red Sox series.
Well, it could be your year. It could be the greatest of next years for a lot of people.
Most certainly.
Thanks very much for the call, Chris.
Thank you.
As you look ahead to this series, Alan Schwartz, Cubs have every chance to get in. The Red Sox currently trail the Yanks 2-1.
No, that's true, but they might even have caught a break yesterday with that rainout, because it's possible that their right-handed pitcher, Derek Lowe, who is outstanding in Fenway Park and decidedly not anywhere else, might get to start Game 5 on Tuesday, which he wouldn't have had the chance to do. So it'll be interesting to see if they catch that break, if they can win tonight, and come back with Derek Lowe tomorrow in a good setting for him. You never know, they might be up 3-2 coming back to New York. We'll have to see, but that there's other gears turning right now.
Though we do, after that Game 3, it looks as if Pedro Martinez and Roger Clemens might square off again, but this time in the Bronx.
Yeah, that would just be outstanding. I can't imagine how much security there would be. I'm not kidding. There will be at that game. It would be incredible. They'll have mounted police in the bullpens, probably.
Let's go now to Gordon, who's with us on the line from Elk Rapids in Michigan.
Hi,
Gordon.
Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay, I got a cell phone here. The 1968 World Series, which the Tigers won, I listened to it live on a place called 881 South in Vietnam, overlooking Khe Sanh.
Wow.
That was at 1 o'clock in the morning live.
That must have been truly remarkable.
Yeah, it was Armed Forces radio that played it, and I was with the Marines. And the Army had a radio relay tower there, a couple of Green Berets. They had a pool going, and I had everybody in my weapons section put all their money on the Tigers, and we cleaned them out.
That was pretty remarkable. I guess I've seen that scene in World War II movies. It's always William Bendix and Lloyd Nolan arguing about the Brooklyns and the Yankees, but I'd never talked to anybody who actually heard the World Series at Khe Sanh in 68. That was pretty dicey at times.
Well, it sure was. We were above the cloud levels, and, it wasn't a very friendly place, but it was nice to be able to hear a ball game live and then win money on it.
Detroit wasn't a very friendly place either.
Not at that time, I heard. I did letters from home about it.
Yeah, there were riots after they won the World Series. Well, Gordon, thanks very much for that recollection.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Here's an email we've gotten from Jim Jacob in Bend, Oregon. I submit the following as the most brilliant managerial move in the series in my years. In 1968, before the designated hitter era, the Tigers had four good hitting outfielders, K-Line, Willie Horton, Mickey Stanley, and Jim Northrup, and a shortstop, Ray Euler, who went 0 for August. Mayo Smith, a stodgy baseball man, moved Mickey Stanley to shortstop for the first time since his minor league days to face Bob Gibson and the rest of the Cardinals. The rest is history. Nice to remember. remember in this year of Tiger futility. That's a pretty good move, Alan.
Oh, sure. I think there are a lot of managerial moves. I mean, just putting Sandy Amoros out in left field that day, I believe, was a big move for Walter Alston back in 1955. And certainly the Brooklyn fans who the previous caller was referring to remember that move. And the idea of it was the slicing ball down the left field line that Yogi Berra hit in an incredibly crucial situation. Amoros, a left-handed fielder, so his glove was on his right hand running toward the line, was able to snag it. Had he not been a left-handed fielder, we probably would not be having this conversation, and that guy's poor father probably would have never recovered.
Let's go now to Richard, who's with us in St. Louis, Missouri.
Hi.
Hiya.
I think I'm one more of the same age that listens to NPR, because my World Series that was the biggest turning point is the 1960s one also. But I think the 1964 series between the Yankees and the Cardinals spelled the end of all-white baseball.
I would agree with that.
Yankees weren't all-white, but they were almost all-white.
Elston Howard played on that team.
Yeah. And Al Downing, I think. The Cardinals' stars were black. The Dodgers the year before. The Giants. Cincinnati. Pittsburgh. Go back a few years. You see the National League mixing the races and having great success, and the Yankees stubbornly holding on. And after 1964, it took them a long time to come back.
Indeed, the National League dominated baseball for a good decade, didn't they, Alan?
Oh, absolutely, and it's particularly the African-American players in the National League. Ever since Jackie Robinson broke the color line, this is, again, off the top of my head, but I think something like 9 out of 10 MVPs from the early 50s to the early 60s in the National League were all black. Ernie Banks, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Roy Campanella, a tremendous amount of African American talent was signed by National League clubs, and the American League was far more reluctant. And I don't want to say far more open. I think I want to say far, far more reluctant to do that. And 1964 really was the symbolic year, and anyone who read David Halberstam's wonderful October 1964, which detailed all the background to this, really can look at that series and also the backdrop of what was happening in the country behind it. I mean, civil rights in 1964 were absolutely inseparable.
There was a wonderful book that came out the same year as October 64, Bob Gibson's Remembrance of the Same Season in Stranger to the Game, where he told about playing in the game and then not being able to get a seat in a restaurant in St. Louis after the game.
Sure, sure. Yeah. But I think that, I mean, one thing I always want to be a little bit careful of is seeing one series as too important. I think it's nice to look at it as symbolic, and it's to us sort of this mental pivot between one era and another. I think we really, you know, as human beings, we cast history into what we need from it. And I think we need to have that one moment where we can say, before that it was bad, after that it was good. But, of course, that really wasn't the case. It's just 1964 helps remind us of the era that was before it and that became after it.
Richard, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're talking with Alan Schwartz, a senior writer for Baseball America, about World Series, past and present. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we have an email from Mark Mance, brother Mark Mance, I guess, in Berkeley, California. My dad wasn't a baseball fan, and growing up, neither was I, until the World Series of 1975 between the Cincinnati Reds, the Big Red Machine, and the Boston Red Sox. What a fantastic battle, with the Reds winning it in the seventh game. Since then, I've always rooted for the Red Sox, unless they are playing the Oakland Athletics, the local team. Okay, but 75 and Carlton Fisk's famous home run in what many call the greatest game ever played, Game 6.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, 1975, I think, has a lot more, again, sort of a pivot, once again, between one era and the next, because that was the beginning of free agency, it was the beginning of arbitration, it was the beginning of, really at the beginning of significant labor strife in baseball. You had the growth of new media and television embracing different technologies. In fact, Carlton Fisk's home run, you know, the image that we know of it, of Fisk madly gesticulating, you know, for the ball to go fair. Mm-hmm. That shot, that wasn't a planned shot. What happened was the cameraman, who was inside the Green Monster behind the left field at Fenway Park, was not supposed to follow Fisk. He was supposed to follow the ball, but he goofed, and he kept his camera on Fisk. And people loved that shot so much. Before that, you didn't really get to see the faces of the players like that. And after that, they decided to make the reaction shot much more of baseball coverage. And so you got to see the eyes of the runner dancing off first base, or the sweat dripping off the pitcher's brow in a tight situation. And we can thank Carlton Fisk's home run for that.
Let's get a quick call from Mike, who's with us in Bend, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you? Well, the email person just ahead of me kind of got my feelings and thoughts on the 75 World Series, watching it live, being a Boston Red Sox fan growing up in Maine, and definitely feeling that lively passion for the game in itself. And I definitely would echo with that sentiment as far as being one of the most phenomenal games ever played.
Well, a little trivia question for you then. Can you remember the winning pitcher in that game?
Oh, goodness. I do not offhand.
Rick Wise was the winning pitcher.
Oh, Rick Wise. That's right. And I think we had, like, I believe Bill Lee may have been one of the relief pitchers at the time. And, yeah, that kind of does start drawing back some memories. another pivotal game, I know it wasn't a World Series game, but also, unfortunately, for the Red Sox, it was with Billy Buckner in the squibber between his legs during the playoffs.
The Game 6 Red Sox fans prefer not to remember.
Yes, exactly. In my opinion, that defined a lot of what continues to be, you know, some extremely bad sentiment and, you know, ill will and bad feeling just with, you know, the fact that the Red Sox just can't quite make that leap. But hopefully if they get there with the Cubbies, I don't care who wins. I'd love to see the Red Sox, but I think it'll just be a phenomenal match one way or the other.
I think it's going to be great baseball no matter what happens.
All right, great.
Thanks very much for the call, Mike.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And we're going to take more of your calls on great World Series of the past and how they shape baseball when we come back from a break, if you'd like to call us. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, TOTN@NPR.org. Also, we'll remember Bill Shoemaker, one of the most successful jockeys in horse racing history. Andy Beyer of the Washington Post will be joining us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, an update on Iraq. We'll talk about the now very public debates inside the Bush administration, the high number of soldier suicides in Iraq, and we'll hear from an NPR reporter with the latest news from the area itself. Today, we're talking about high and low moments in World Series history and how they've shaped the game. Which ones stand out for you? Join the conversation. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. And our guest is senior writer for Baseball America, Alan Schwartz. He's in our New York bureau. And let's go to another caller. And it's Chris, who's with us from Williamsburg, Virginia.
Hi there, Neil. What I wanted to comment on was what I think is probably the most consequential World Series in the last couple of decades, which was the World Series of 1994, obviously the one that didn't happen. Which, you know, turned so many fans away from baseball. I have to admit that as a baseball fan, I couldn't, much as it probably would have been the righteous thing to do to turn away from baseball at that point, I just couldn't, and I still can't. But I don't know that I've ever felt so low about baseball as I did at that point.
I don't think you're alone in that sentiment, Chris. Alan Schwartz, certainly if 1975 and Carlton Fisk suddenly made baseball seem cool again, 1994 was a terrible, terrible year for baseball.
No, I think that's certainly true. But then again, I think that people overestimate sometimes the effect of that World Series and the effect of how it didn't take place. Of course, there was a lot of ill feeling about that, and that goes without saying. But everyone who thought it would be the death of baseball, the caller alluded to it, both the owners and the players at that time knew that the popularity of sports runs in cycles, and whatever down period that they might have endured in 94 and 95, that it would rebound. It always does. In fact, I mean, I wrote a column back then saying that within 5 years, baseball would be the hottest sport in the country again.
And in 1998, it was.
And it was, because things happen. People get bored of the NBA and Michael Jordan and all that. And Magic Johnson, of course, got sick. And Larry Bird retired. And you know, the NBA fell off a little bit. And baseball came forward with new faces like McGuire and Sosa. You know, Mark McGuire and Sammy Sosa, of course. I think that that the corollary to all this is the Yankees winning in 1996 did an awful lot to help baseball get back. We all know about Cal Ripken breaking Lou Gehrig's record in 1995. We know all about the home run chase of 98. Forgotten in there is a World Series moment, and that was that the Yankees won in 96. And I think that that probably had something to do with Madison Avenue getting excited about baseball again and being reminded about how much fun it could be. And that put a lot more than 2 years of distance in between the debacle of 94 and what became here in New York the euphoria of 96.
Chris, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Kate. And Kate's with us from Grand Rapids in Michigan.
Hi, good afternoon. I felt that we should have a female voice in this. In my family, it's the women that like baseball. One of my favorite moments was for two reasons. One, it was in the 84 series with the Tigers and the Padres, and Goose Gossage was like begging and begging to pitch to Kirk Gibson after he'd already hit one home run. And he won the argument, and Kirk just blasted it out of the park. And at the same time, my little white-haired Lutheran grandmother, who was like 82 years old, we'd taken her to a sports bar to watch the game. And she was one of these people that was compulsively tidy, always very polite and quiet in public, screamed at the top of her lungs and threw a whole basket of popcorn up in the air.
Alan Schwartz, that Kirk Gibson home run, which I think we all remember now from all those replays, is
sure.
I can't believe what I just saw.
Well, that was actually 88.
That was 88.
That was 88. That was when he hit the home run off of Dennis Eckersley when Kirk Gibson
hurt.
was all but an amputee striding up to the plate. But in 84, it was a big home run off of Goose Gossage that helped the Tigers win that series.
And again, the moment you're talking about, Kate, reminded me of the confrontation between, and Alan, you're going to have to help me, the Reggie Jackson then with the Yankees and another Los Angeles Dodger pitcher, a young kid, a fastballer, who later had trouble with some substance abuse problems. But the great confrontation where he struck Reggie out at the end of, I think it was Game 2 in the World Series.
That was Bob Welsh
in,
I believe, 1978. Of course, Reggie had the 3-home run game in Game 6 of 1977 when the Yankees won their first World Series in whatever many years, with 15 years or so. And but then Welsh came back the next year, and the Dodgers' young pitcher, he was 20 years old, and we know now probably, very well might have been, in the throes of young alcoholism at that time, came in and was facing Reggie, and just everyone was going crazy, and he struck him out. And a lot of people remember that at-bat. It didn't have a whole lot to do with the outcome of the series, but, boy, what an exciting confrontation.
Kate, thanks very much.
Thanks. You notice all the Tiger fans that are calling in and talking about Old World Series?
Yeah.
Because we have nothing. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Kate. Let's go to Sharon, another woman on the show. Sharon's with us from Miami, Florida.
Hi. Yeah, I'm calling from Miami to talk to you about the lowest point, I think, in the World Series, and that was when Wayne Huizenga purchased all of these players for the Marlins with the express idea of winning the World Series, which he did, and then immediately disbanded the team. And I was really surprised that even in Miami there were more cries for his head, because to me it was crass commercialism.
Yeah, he bought all those players with the idea of getting enough public support to then build a new ballpark, and when that wasn't, when the taxpayers proved to be resistant to the raid on their pocketbooks, he then promptly sold them all away.
He already had pro player.
Well, yes, but now you've got another great team and playing for the National League pennant.
Yeah, well, that's the high point, but I will tell you that after this happened, so many people down here were just really sworn off of baseball.
Yeah.
And it just was commercialism at its absolute worst. And I am still surprised that people aren't more angry about what happened and how that happened. It just seemed it cheapened the entire game.
Well, I'd like to ask you a question, ma'am.
Yeah.
1997, you had this team of sort of mercenaries, all those guys, Moises Alou
right.
and Gary Sheffield and all these guys coming in just to win the series that one year.
Yeah.
And then this year, 6 years later, you have a team of, a lot of homegrown guys, or at least guys who have been around for a while.
Right.
How do you compare
Jeff Conine back?
Yeah, exactly. How do you remember feeling about the 97 team? Do you feel more loyalty towards this one, even if they win the World Series?
Yeah, I do feel more loyalty to this one, because I feel like they're not in it just for the money. And it's hard enough nowadays to have people be loyal to teams. It's not like it was 20, 30, 40 years ago where, you know, you were a fan no matter what happened with your team.
Mm-hmm.
Like that anymore. People are almost have the mentality of the channel surfing. They just flip from team to team, and they really are very much fair weather friends and fair weather fans. So I think there's a lot more enthusiasm now.
Sharon, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
And let's go quickly to Sonny, and Sonny is in Greencastle, Indiana.
Yes. I was calling because you were talking about the 75 World Series, specifically Game 6, and I was 10 years old when that was going on, and that was a night game that I wasn't supposed to be able to stay up and watch, but as the game went on, and with all the wonderful things that happened in the game, my dad felt compelled to let me stay up. It was one of those great male bonding moments between me and my dad, and the next day when he was at work, one of his customers came in and, of course, asked him if he saw the game, and he said, yeah, and I even let my 10-year-old son stay up past midnight to watch that game. And he said, well, that's good, because he'll remember that the rest of his life.
And so far, so good.
Absolutely. It's one of those great memories, high moments and low moments. I remember Fred Lynn hitting the center field wall trying to catch a fly ball, and Fenway Park being totally hushed in silence as the trainers and other attended to him and hoping that he turned out all right, which he did. But it was high drama at both ends of the scale.
No, memories of that game are, you know, one of the best scenes of Good Will Hunting was when Matt Damon, you know, the kid who never got along with anyone and didn't want to deal with Robin Williams, the psychiatrist, all of a sudden they bonded because Matt Damon had learned that his doctor had not gone to Game 6. He's like, how could you not go to Game 6? You could have gone to Game 6. And he said, I had to see about a girl.
Yeah.
And it's just wonderful, just wonderful.
We have a nice email from John Pace in Salt Lake City. At Prescott Elementary School in Lincoln, Nebraska, during the early and middle 60s, there was one criteria for whether a teacher was a good one or a bad one. Would they let you listen to the weekday series games on the radio? Of course, they're not during the day too much on the radio anymore. The earliest they start is 4 o'clock Eastern time, which is, I guess, when we're going to hear game 5 or game 4 of whichever one, tomorrow's Boston New York game from Fenway Park. Sonny, thanks very much for calling us.
All right, thanks.
Thanks very much for the memory. And Alan Schwartz, as always, good to have you on the show.
It was my pleasure, Neil.
Alan Schwartz is a senior writer for Baseball America. He joined us from our bureau in New York.